are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 12th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jonathan Tepper, co-author of The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies, and the Death of Competition. Also on the program, a deal supposedly struck, I feel like I said this yesterday, to keep the government open as labor drops the hammer. Meanwhile, hundreds die in a Brazil dam disaster under a libertarian's dream regulatory scheme. State of Utah flips off its voters and shrinks its Medicaid expansion. Ilhan Omar apologizes for what Tom Friedman gets paid to say. Kamala Harris, new revelations of her prosecutorial past, means she has some explaining to do. Meanwhile, speaking of explaining to do, Amy Klobuchar facing an avalanche of criticism from ex-staffers. Who knew? Apparently, a lot of people. And lastly, Rick Scott, who took the Fifth dozens of times in a Medicaid fraud case, says, "Trust me, I don't need a blind trust." All this,
I plead the Fifth.
And more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Happy birthday to my dad.
Happy birthday, Mr. Steeder.
It just occurred to me as I was reading off the date that today is my dad's birthday. Now, he's out of town. I already got him a present, so I'm covered. But just going to make myself a note.
Is your dad? Is he in Vegas?
Email party. Dad. I don't know. He's on the road somewhere.
Never you mind.
None of your business. None of my business. I understand. welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone's here today. We have Matt, Jamie, Brendan, Michael, all in studio so that you don't get shocked if you hear someone's voice. Folks, want to remind you, Candace Owens, the number two. Is she number two at Turning Points? Turning Points USA has had a very difficult go of things as of late. I think they were they were exposed as to having very little savvy when it came to setting up a Twitter account in the UK. They didn't wait for verification. And then some rapscallions created other TP UK accounts, and no one could tell which ones the real ones were. They were so close to parody. The legit TP UK that people had trouble telling them apart. And then somebody goes and digs around on the success of their Facebook advertising campaigns. And it turns out an organization dedicated to trying to propagandize to college students, their biggest, all of their campaigns seem to resonate most with men over the ages of 65. Now, I don't want to go too far. I don't want to lean too far out ahead of my skis because it's possible a lot of those people will return to college, folks. I don't know. And then Candace Owens over in Great Britain, again, promoting the expansion of TP UK, basically said, you know, Hitler, his nationalism at home was okay. It was that he tried to, it was his sort of, I don't think she used the word imperialism, but it was just that he tried to.
Globalism.
The only bad stuff that Hitler did was the stuff that she's mad at Jews for doing.
Right.
Globalism.
The globalism was the bad stuff. The stuff at home, she was just trying to make Germany better. You know,
make Germany great.
Right. I mean,
Germany great again.
Make Germany great again. Make it just more German, if you will.
More national.
Right. And so then she got into hot water, and apparently she had to go on a tour where she pretended she was misunderstood. And unfortunately, they let her describe what she said, and it didn't really work out any better. Here she is on Lou Dobbs, and... you know, who better to speak to walk through this minefield than Lou Dobbs?
Great to have you here. Let's start.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to see you. I want to start by addressing some of the remarks of yours from late last year that were dredged up by a leftist advocacy group.
Pause it. Late last year, as if like, okay, that's a month and a half ago. And they weren't dredged up. They did a public, like, they were on stage. This is not like they dredged it up from a conversation you were having
like Titanic.
At a pub. Yeah, exactly. They had to really go way down to the depths, like almost like to the website that you run and actually pull it off the website.
To attack you, claiming you seem to defend Hitler while explaining the term nationalism. Your thoughts. I know you tried to straighten this thing out last Friday.
Well, look, you and I both know what this is, obviously. The left has me as a major target because I have been effective at delivering conservative principles to the Black American community. Plain and simple. They have the number one target because I am leading a revolution called Blexit, which is going to encourage Black Americans to finally look at the real history, the very racist history.
Not for nothing, but if you're leading a revolution and you have to explain what the name of it is, it may not be quite the revolution you think it is.
It is called the struggle for Indian independence. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone. It's the salt march. It'll make our heads spin.
There you go.
Finally look at the real history, the very racist history of the Democrat Party, which has not served us. So first they ignored me, okay? Then they laughed at me, and now they are fighting me at every turn.
Oh, they're going to try
the most ridiculous thing. The most ridiculous.
I'm sorry. Pause it again. I'm sorry. To be honest, and I hope I'm not telling any secrets of the left and the Democrat folks, but we're still on the laughing stage.
Yes,
we're still at the laugh.
Don't rush our process.
Right, exactly. Give us a little bit of time here.
The idea that I, a person who flew 30 hours, Candace.
Let's get to the point here.
Go backwards, please. Is she saying? I thought she was going to go like the idea, me, a person of color, saying that Hitler was great. No, she's talking about I flew 30 hours.
Laughed at me, and now they are fighting me at every turn.
Oh, they're going to try
the most ridiculous thing.
Candace, let's get to the point here. This business with Hitler and nationalism, you are a number one target or among the number one targets for Media Matters, for all the left-wing advocacy groups. They're going to try
Correct.
To kill you, figuratively speaking.
I flew 30 hours!
No doubt. Straighten out
Without
this thing
doubt.
With Hitler and and nationalism, real quick, if you would.
The discussion was about nationalism and whether it's okay for conservatives to say that they are nationalists. And what I said is that the word nationalism is wrongly attributed to Hitler because he was not a nationalist. He was not focused on trying to bring the Germans to a better state because he was actively killing German Jews. He was also trying to...
The last time we talked about this, it was like she really needs a remedial history course. But she really needs a remedial history course. The idea for Hitler was that he was trying to make Germany great again, to borrow a phrase.
No, he did say that.
I flew
to borrow a phrase from him, I guess.
I flew 30 hours, and boy, do I have positive feelings towards Hitler.
And it's just that one of the ways that he went about it, one of the only one. I mean, he wanted to increase the industrialization, and there was a lot of
some
other
imperialism.
One of the ways was to get rid of those who were diluting the German culture, according to him. They were almost, if you would call it, like aliens, for as far as he was concerned, illicit aliens. Almost.
And it didn't start out as we're going to kill the Jews. It was like, oh, we're just going to put them back where they belong elsewhere.
They had a lot of different...
The Jews were not dialogue with us about
this. They were deporting them. They just couldn't find places to go. But you see, they had multiple solutions. And then the one where they started to kill the Jews was the last or the final solution, if you will. Let's hear. Maybe she salvages this.
Nationalism is wrongly attributed to Hitler because he was not a nationalist. He was not focused on trying to bring the Germans to a better state because he was actively killing German Jews. He was also trying to expand, and he was an imperialist. Exactly. He was a homicidal maniac, and we need to stop associating nationalism with
two of the most two of the evilest figures in history.
Evil.
So absolutely. Have you learned a lesson
disgusting.
Here? Let me just curious,
yes,
because in this business, it's a very simple thing, the news business. Anybody who brings up Hitler loses every single
time. I've learned that.
Okay, so when you look for a metaphor, take it from the old guy. Find another metaphor. Find another symbol. Another symbol.
I will totally take that advice. I've learned my lesson.
Well, and you are, because you are such a target, you have to be keenly aware at all
extra
times.
Extra careful.
And you are. And just enough said. Let's turn to Virginia.
And Lou Dobbs, I want to hear that part. And then Lou Dobbs is like, trust me, I've been trying to explain that Hitler wasn't that bad for a long time, young lady. And it's a tough road to hoe. You got to pick your battles. Media Matters can come after you every day.
What's shocking about that was Lou Dobbs basically tees up the... What are your thoughts about that? In other words, I know your people have told me that you want to explain this. You probably have something prepared. So I'm not even going to ask you a question other than time for you to speak and justify your words. And she still steps in it again. Almost in the identical
I would like
way.
To clarify exactly what I was saying, which was that Hitler, great domestic policy, overly aggressive foreign policy. Thank you.
Wow.
Well,
yeah, that was a little rough. Stalin was also bad, but let me just be clear here. It's tough. You talk about how good Hitler was off the record.
I'd like to see inside the chat at TPUSA right now. They're probably like, oh, so we're saying the Holocaust did happen. Okay.
Right, exactly.
No, the chat is, guys, can you please stop saying the Holocaust didn't happen so much? We've already seen that chat. Don't be so friggin' overtly.
Oh, that's right.
We've literally seen
exchanges from TPUSA in like their Florida chapter, like, hey, if we're going to use this Slack channel, stop saying, like, you know, the Jews are bad for no reason.
Yeah, only when they deserve it.
Yeah, you know, guys, we're trying to be a serious organization, and you're going to need to say that the Jews are global bloodsuckers when it's part of a policy argument.
Just avoid saying the N-word, and don't reference Richard Spencer too much, and don't Jew hate Just Cause all the time.
Just Cause.
You got to have a reason, folks.
Where's the lie?
Fast the lie.
It's just trying to make Germany great again.
Thanks for having me on, Lou. Really innovative in domestic policy, but actually kind of Jewy in foreign policy. Thank you. I'll see you next week on the A Block.
Folks, a lot of times we get emails. I don't say every email, but I would say 70% of emails that we get, regardless of what their content are, end with somebody saying, hey, guys, thanks for keeping me sane for X number of years or months or whatever it is. There's another way in which you can sort of maintain some sanity in this era, basically by slowing down and being mindful. Imagine how many goals and how much calmer you would be if you could do that. Well, that's why we're excited to partner with Calm, the number one app to help you meditate, sleep, and relax. Practices like meditation and prioritizing sleep can leave you feeling more rested, so you have the energy to go out and achieve your goals. If you head to calm.com/majority, get 25% off a Calm Premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programs like guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. There are sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. They're designed to help you relax before you doze off. These are actually pretty great. And because I grew up listening to talk radio, and that's the way I would go to sleep. But when you were a kid, you know, listening in Worcester, talk radio was a little bit more benign than it is
now. Can we put on Bob Grant so I can get lulled to sleep, please?
No, but this is nice. I like the idea of...
I'm very excited for you to try all of these applications, now, Sam. Trust me.
The downside is they also have... there's that Lavender Fields of France with Stephen Fry. No, I can't go there. Because I wake up...
Oh, no, it just goes dramatically.
Stephen Fry is so good that he makes Sam have an allergic reaction just to the narration.
Exactly. But
Stephen Fry is that good.
Exploring New Zealand with Jerome Flynn from Game of Thrones is pretty cool. For a limited time, Majority Report listeners get 25% off a Calm Premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's Calm, C-A-L-M. .com/majority. Get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/majority. Give yourself the gift of calm and start 2019 off right. This is pretty amazing, and I guess a confession to make about this. I'm kind of addicted to this. And I don't think that's the way that it was meant to be used. But do you remember 1989, the year the World Wide Web was invented? We've come a long way since then. So why does it feel like the software you use every day at work is stuck in the past? Take a leap into the future by finding the right software for your business on Capterra.com, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra has everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories of software, from project management to email marketing. No matter what your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. All right, so when they came to me and asked if I would take Capterra as a... to do a live read, because I won't do it for companies that I don't, I have a problem with or I check out and I just think they aren't a good fit. So if you head over to Capterra.com and go to the categories, there's literally, 700 specific categories of software. And I have been going through these different categories, and it's a review site on the specific software, but I'm just amazed at the different businesses that you can look at. Like, there's a gamification software. And so I go in and I just start looking, and I think I'm starting to have like some type of, I don't think there's a midlife crisis, but I'm contemplating like, oh, a coaching software. Maybe I could become an online coach or something. Like, I started looking for new jobs I could have. Festival management software. I could do a festival. And there's literally, for festival management software, I'm just looking at it right now, there's literally like 25 different softwares that are developed, I guess, if you have a festival management company. There's a data loss prevention software, delivery management software, government software, GPS tracking software, gradebook software. On and on. I'm just going HVAC software. I have no idea what you would do with software, but all these, no matter what kind of company you have, they apparently have software for it. And this aggregates all the different types of software for you. So you can visit Capterra.com/majority. If you don't have a business, you can also spend like hours on it, like I have, just sort of fantasizing, like
all of the possibilities.
I mean, I could go right now. I could just become a nutrition analyst,
Billy McFarland. Yes,
analysis because
a nutrition
I got the software.
Guy. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, maybe that's not so much for me, but oil and gas software, if I wanted to get into that biz.
I could see that, actually.
Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. That's Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, Capterra.com/majority. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Jonathan Tepper on the myth of capitalism, monopolies, and the death of competition. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the founder of Variant Perception, the author with Denise Hearn of The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies and the Death of Competition. Jonathan Tepper, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So the story of how you decided to write this book is a funny one, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, what's interesting to me, not just about what you've assembled here in the context of your book, and we've talked about antitrust issues quite a bit on this program, but is that I think probably from a political standpoint, you're not necessarily coming from the same place as a lot of you're not necessarily coming from the same place as I think a lot of the guests that we have on this program. Generally speaking, but tell us how you came to writing this book.
Certainly. So I didn't really sort of, I'm not an expert in antitrust or monopolies by way of background. I didn't really sort of think I was going to end up writing a book about this. I hope I've become somewhat of an expert in the process of reading thousands of academic papers and hundreds of books. But the funny thing is, I actually provide research to hedge funds and to very wealthy families, what are known as sort of family offices that invest their money. And, you know, what I try to do with my day job is, you know, try to tell them, you know, is the stock market going to go up or not? Will government bond yields go up or down? That's sort of what I do for a living. The way I came to this book was because we build leading economic indicators. So, for example, you know, is the U.S. going to go into a recession is the kind of question that our indicator should answer. Is inflation going to go up or down? And one of the key questions or key indicators that we have is our leading indicator for U.S. wages. And so this indicator has worked over many years. And what it does is it tells you whether workers will be getting a raise or not. And the reason that this matters is because when workers are getting big raises, typically company return on equity and company operating margins go down. And that's just what happens late in the economic cycle generally. And it affects corporate profits and return on equity. And so I thought, you know, our leading indicator was important because it matters a lot for investors, but it just stopped working. And our indicator was turning up. It was going up a lot, and wages weren't going up. And so I hate being wrong. And, you know, I was telling clients, just wait, you know, the wages are going to go up. And as all your listeners know, wages in the U.S. have been fairly pathetic for over a decade. And so, you know, it just troubled me. I wanted to get to the bottom of it and figure out why it was wrong. And at the same time as I was sort of playing around with this question, trying to find the answers, Piketty's book came out. And Thomas Piketty basically wrote a book describing the rise in inequality. And he said that he had found a fatal flaw in capitalism. And he argued that when growth was low, that returns on capital would be very high, and, you know, workers' returns to labor would be very low, and this would drive inequality even higher. And, I'm an investment analyst. I look at companies. I've built hundreds of financial models, and his ideas just made no sense at all to me. You know, one, growth is not very good for returns on capital, but secondly, more importantly, if you have a business that has very high returns on capital, you know, I'm going to be attracted to those returns. I'm going to want some of your money, and I'm going to go in and compete with you. And so I thought, you know, competition is what brings down returns on capital. And so I thought the place I need to go look is probably on the competition side. You know, like if returns on capital are not going down, then there's probably not enough competition. And so I ended up doing a lot of research, and the best paper I read was by Gustavo Grillon and some of his colleagues, and it's called Are U.S. Industries Becoming More Concentrated? And what he found was that in most industries, what we've seen is less and less competition, fewer and fewer players. And so what you end up with is not necessarily outright monopolies, and there are some, but actually sort of oligopolies or duopolies. And these are essentially like, you know, industries that are dominated by two or three or four companies, and there's very, very little competition. And so that, I think, is at the root of a lot of the problems that we see in terms of low wages, low economic dynamism. And, I would put myself sort of right of center. You know, I love free markets. I love capitalism. I think it's the most wonderful thing ever. And I think that the real problem here is that we don't actually have enough competition. And so Joseph Stiglitz described this as ersatz capitalism. So it sort of looks like capitalism, but it's not. And right now what you have in the United States is, in theory, this is like the greatest free market in the world. And actually there's very little free markets and very little competition.
Okay, and so let's dig into this, and it's and so we're looking at this lack of competition that is, I guess I don't know if it's an explicitly antitrust a monopoly, but like you say, oligopoly, and you write that there's certainly major players out there who understand this dynamic and have been profiting off it. And you talk about Warren Buffett and Silicon Valley. Let's talk about, in particular, Silicon Valley, because that is one of the that seems to be one of the more, I think, pronounced, or at least maybe we're a little bit myopic here, because obviously we're online to a large extent. But the tech world seems to be one where we have, which is highly problematic in that regard.
Yes, I think that the tech giants, these tech monopolies, are really attracting an enormous amount of attention right now, because everyone interacts with Facebook, everyone interacts with Google. And so these are drawing a lot of attention, and in a way, they're the lightning rod. But, you know, in the book, we go industry by industry. And in fact, there's an enormous number of industries, particularly the U.S. healthcare sector, which is one of the most messed up and broken sectors of the economy, that, you know, is eating up essentially about one fifth of GDP. You know, unlike almost any other developed country in the world, it has almost no competition. And so, but I'm you know, thrilled, though, that people are focusing on the tech giants, and this is bringing about this antitrust.
Let's get we'll get to hospitals. I want to get to hospitals. I want to get to cable and airlines. But let's start with some of those big tech giants, because I think people don't understand I mean, there's been a lot of debate, you know, around things like Google and Facebook. Should we nationalize them? I mean, how do we deal? We hear it in the context of certain people being deplatformed or whatnot. But there is a lot of sort of economic. There's a lot. There's different silos. It seems to me that are problematic with these things. But from a purely economic standpoint. Google and Facebook are highly problematic in terms of entrepreneurship, and explain that.
Yes, one of the principal problems that we've seen now, essentially with Google and Facebook, is that the internet itself was meant to be open and free, slightly anarchic. You know, in the early days, you had DARPA. It was meant to withstand a nuclear bomb. The idea was that you would have a blog, I would have a web page and a blog. We might link to each other, and then we might link to someone else. And, you know, you'd have this very rich set of connections. And, you know, it was very decentralized. Unfortunately, what's happened is that Google and Facebook essentially now mediate over half of all the internet traffic. And so that really passed 50% in 2014. And Tim Berners-Lee created essentially, you know, the World Wide Web through his standards. And, you know, he's a legend, you know, in terms of his involvement with the internet. And he thinks that the internet itself is dying. You know, he said that in various articles. And unfortunately, we've gone from sort of a very free and open competitive internet, essentially, to one that's highly centralized for the benefit of a few players. And people often say, well, Google is just so much better at what it does, or Facebook's just incredible at what it does. You know, how can you complain? And the products are free. And the problem is that if you look at the tech giants, you know, the fangs, you know, so the Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, they've done, and including Microsoft, they've done, you know, over 430 acquisitions over the last 10 years. None of these have been challenged by regulators. And so what's ended up happening is that Google has been able to buy DoubleClick. DoubleClick did display ads. Google did search ads. Facebook was able to buy WhatsApp, was able to buy Instagram. So essentially, the advertising duopoly, where basically Google and Facebook are the only ones capturing any additional ad dollars, this duopoly that exists was one that the regulators themselves gave the green light to. And so, you know, their dominance of the online world was in no way inevitable and was essentially allowed to happen through very, very bad antitrust regulation or lack of regulation, rather. And I think that the big problem with these two platforms is that broken markets create broken politics. And so to the extent that they're very powerful, they're able to then further control politics, further control regulators. And, you know, it's particularly troubling that under the Obama administration, no company had as many visits to the White House as Google did. So, you know, Google was visiting many times a week to the White House. They were able to place their own former lawyers at the FTC, you know, and Library of Congress. And so, you know, the Patent Office. And so in the end, the internet ends up reflecting the interests and the needs of Facebook and Google rather than of the consumer. And beyond that, if you look at the sort of collapse in royalties to artists and to creators and the collapse in newspapers, what we've seen essentially is one of the greatest arbitrages of all time, which is that, you know, it takes you time and energy to make this show. It takes writers time and energy to write. And what ends up happening is that basically Google and Facebook can monetize the content with, you know, without any need essentially to recompense the people who create these. And so I think that it's very unhealthy. You know, if we think that what we need is a lively ecosystem in the wild, you know, whether it's in jungles or in forests or in the natural world, you know, basically we're ending up with a less diverse and a less rich ecosystem online by having essentially two dominant players completely control the economics.
Let's talk about the solutions. I mean, but for a moment, I want to take just a slight tangent here because, you know, and just go a little further into, like, for instance, what Facebook has done, for instance, to journalism, right? Where you have, we just had massive layoffs over the past month from Huffington Post, from BuzzFeed, one or two others. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. But I know that what happened was, you know, that a place like BuzzFeed, they basically gave up their website. I mean, it still exists, but in terms of a source of traffic, and they just went all in on Facebook. And Facebook just decided, we're going to do it a little bit differently. We're just not going to pay you in that same way. And it ends up destroying or severely debilitating a major media outlet. What's interesting, too, I mean, from your perspective, and this is, I think it's very helpful to see it in the context of economics only, but it's not just from a perspective of the consumer, right? I mean, because what we're talking about is problematic for citizens, because we have these policies that are that, you know, the lack of journalism doesn't necessarily hurt me as a consumer per se. Right. I mean, it hurts me as a citizen. And we're talking about the oversized sort of political strength that a Google or a Facebook has because they've been able to amass such an amazing amount of money and market share in this space.
Absolutely. So, you know, in this past month, we've seen the new book has come out called Zucked by Roger McNamee. It's a great book. I highly recommend your readers read it. And, you know, the book that I've written with my co-writer, The Myth of Capitalism, is very much on the sort of economic side and antitrust. What's very interesting is that sort of McNamee looks very much at the danger to democracy and the danger to the body politic that comes from sort of Facebook and Google, where, you know, you have essentially these are sort of attention magnets. They know almost everything about the people who see them and view them. And they serve up essentially ads and information that's not necessarily true, not necessarily verified or good. And the algorithms that promote content tend to promote the wildest and, you know, most sort of engaging content, whether it's true or not. And, you know, I think that's not a price problem. That's not an economic problem, but it certainly isn't a tremendous democratic problem. And I think that the other big problem here is that, like, you know, I point out in the book that they do offer their own content, yet they're like platforms. So, you know, they have no responsibility what's on their site. They're just a platform. And yet at the same time, you know, Facebook and Google both pay for an enormous amount of actual real content. You have YouTube Studios and so on. So they have the best of all worlds, which is that they're not responsible for any of the stuff that goes up on the platform, yet at the same time, they're very happy to pay to create content to engage people. You know, and you and I, for example, you know, if we started to put out content, we would be content creators. We'd be responsible for our content. You know, we couldn't just claim to be platforms. So they have it both ways when it comes to that.
And I know that there's an analogy in what we can do to sort of address the problems in the tech world, as maybe also, you know, when it comes to hospitals and other industries, cable, airlines, et cetera. But specifically, like, how, because I think there's a lack of imagination of like how you would deal with specifically like a Facebook and a Google if you were to apply a different concept than we've had in this country, really, since Bork, I guess, in the 80s, to antitrust when looking at these companies, like from a practical standpoint, what would you do with a Facebook or a Google, broadly speaking, to diminish their monopoly, their monopolistic, I guess, hold on the internet?
So I think that, so in the last chapter of the book, The Myth of Capitalism, we offer some specific solutions, and those do apply to Facebook and Google, and they apply to all industries. But for example, I mentioned that there were a few acquisitions that should never have gone through. I think the first step, what we have to do is to, one is prevent further acquisitions that are bad and anti-competitive. And then secondly, undo any previous acquisitions that have been anti-competitive. And I think that if you look at whether it's DoubleClick or AdMob, whether it's Instagram or WhatsApp, these are acquisitions that are blatantly anti-competitive, and that these companies should be broken up. And it would not be the end of the world. Companies spin off units all the time. Standard Oil was broken up. AT&T was broken up. It's no surprise, by the way, that the internet revolution itself happened basically about 10 years after AT&T was broken up. You know, you ended up with competition, you ended up with innovation. And I think that if we did that to the internet giants, the world would be a much better place.
But I mean, would you say, okay, I mean, to the extent that these companies have now been absorbed by the Borg, though, would you say, like, okay, we're going to, the advertising and the search functions need to be distinct, or the messaging and the posting functions need to be distinct, or how would there be any broad principles, or would it literally be like, okay, you bought these 100 companies, they all need to be spun off at this point?
Well, I think when you look at, for example, what's happened with Google buying DoubleClick, right? Basically, Google completely dominated the search. They were able to then get a very significant hold in the display market. Or you look at Facebook, essentially, which had Facebook itself, and then was able to buy Instagram, essentially a direct competitor to itself. These are essentially, and then WhatsApp obviously was able to, they were then able to tie everyone's phone numbers and personal information together. What's happened is, you know, there's a sort of network effect where the more information they amass about people, the more they're then able to serve to advertisers, and advertisers only want to advertise to whoever has the most data on the actual searchers or users. And so these were, blatantly sort of anti-competitive acquisitions that were done to further entrench themselves. And I would be thrilled if we could break up Google and Facebook. Tim Wu has talked about this. He wrote a great book called The Curse of Bigness. And he goes through sort of some antitrust monopoly history. If you look at Europe and even the U.S., there have been agreements between Google and Facebook and the regulators, and the competition authorities regarding the sharing of data. It's no surprise that Facebook has hired former antitrust people now, and Zuckerberg is talking about merging WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and Facebook together, because he obviously wants to preempt any breaking up, right, you know, where it would be easier to do, and wants to make it much harder. What's very interesting is they're actually, Google and Facebook have consistently violated the privacy of their users. There are consent decrees with the regulators regarding how personal data should be treated. These consent decrees are generally not being observed, yet regulators have done nothing. And so I do think that there's grounds for going after them on that. But you know, these are platforms that don't like competition, are able to buy their competitors, and then don't really have any enforcement of consent decrees by the regulators.
All right, let's talk about hospitals, because there's a lot of folks out there who think that obviously we're talking a lot about single payer these days in the news, but there's a lot of people who think ultimately you're not going to be able to get the prices down unless you deal with the monopolistic practices of local hospitals. Break that down for us.
So if you look at the rest of the world, you have some countries that have a socialized healthcare system. I currently live in London, and I grew up in Spain. The UK has the National Health Service, and Spain has their National Health Service. Those are essentially government-run healthcare systems. Both work pretty well, and they do so generally with about 10% of GDP. The U.S. is basically almost 19% of GDP, about 18.5%. So we're spending an order of magnitude higher, essentially, on healthcare than a nationalized system. You could also look at countries around the world that have private systems, but where the government makes sure that everyone has coverage. So those are like Belgium, France, and Switzerland. So it's possible to have a private system, and it's possible to have a government-run system. But in both cases, they spend a significant amount less than the U.S. does. The U.S. essentially has the worst of all worlds. The U.S. has essentially one where the government has extensive regulations and does pay a lot. But you also have essentially – you don't have universal coverage. And you have private monopolies and oligopolies that operate at every level in every sector of the U.S. healthcare market. So, for example, 90% of urban hospital markets in the U.S. are what are known as highly concentrated, according to the Department of Justice guidelines, in terms of, you know, few players. And it means that when you don't have any choice about where you need to go get your operation done or any medical treatment, the hospital has complete pricing power over you. You know, when it comes to, for example, the price of a bar of chocolate, if someone told you it was like 10 times more expensive, you'd say, you know what, I'm just not going to eat chocolate. I'll have something else. Economists call that essentially elasticity of demand. When it comes to hospital services, when you need medical care, like, you know, you will pay through the nose because you need it. And so demand is completely inelastic, and they know that. And so hospital prices have just kept on rising and rising, and we've seen more and more mergers. And unfortunately, Obamacare encouraged more mergers. And so even if you went to essentially a Medicare for all, but you didn't deal with the underlying problem of monopolies and oligopolies, whether it's in pharma, whether it's in group purchasing organizations for hospitals, hospitals themselves, the insurance markets in the U.S. are extremely concentrated. All of these corporate entities, you know, would still be able to gouge the government if the government wasn't able to negotiate them down, and, you know, if the competition was not increased.
Now, do you think that in that context, so what's the solution there? Because can you break up a hospital? I mean, isn't the only solution there to have a player who is big enough to say, like, we have all the buyers and you may be concentrated in terms of sellers, but we have all the buyers. So, you're going to have to deal with us. We have the same ability to walk away from you as you do to us. Or is there another way?
So what you're talking about is the term is monopsony. So a monopoly is where there's one seller, right? So, for example, like back in the day, Standard Oil was the one company that would sell you oil, and they were the monopolist. A monopsony is where there's one buyer. So, for example, in a coal town, the coal company is the only buyer for labor, right? And so that's referred to as the monopsony, the only buyer. Amazon, as it turns out right now, is the only buyer for books. And so they're a monopsony on the book front. The government could be a monopsony for medical care, meaning the government's like, you know what, we're the only ones who are going to be buying medical care here, and we'll tell you what the prices are going to be. That is essentially what happens in the UK under a nationalized healthcare system. It's what happens in Spain. And that is one option. I don't know if politically Americans are there yet. Right. But you could have a perfectly workable private market that works very well. The problem is that there's very little competition. Believe it or not, you can't sell insurance across state lines, right? You can sell pencils across state lines. You can sell Coca-Cola across state lines, but you cannot sell insurance across state lines. So let me just
stop you there. I know that there has been multiple pilot programs where we have been able to sell insurance across state lines, but the insurance companies found that they couldn't determine the risk pools in these other markets, and they decided it's just not worth their while.
Well, the insurance market in the U.S. is governed by the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which essentially exempts insurance from antitrust supervision and allows the states to regulate insurance companies rather than the federal government. So the federal government regulates, for example, financial markets via the SEC, the Federal Reserve, and you have the FDIC for banks. But the states regulate the insurance companies. And so in many states, for example, like Alabama and Hawaii, you have one company which basically has about 65% market share. There's over 20 states where you have the top two players essentially have over 60% market share. There's very, very little competition when it comes to insurance. There's very little competition when it comes to hospitals. There's very little competition when it comes to pharma, due to the way that the patent systems work and the FDA approvals. And so I think that if what you want to do is go the private route, so let's say the Americans don't want a British National Health Service, you know, which is a perfectly fine thing to want, you know, if they want a private market, the way that they can improve, the way Americans could improve the system is to say, okay, let's get a lot more competition in here. Let's make sure that people are duking it out, fighting, trying to provide better, cheaper services, and eliminate, you know, almost all barriers. And the problem is right now, there are just so many barriers in terms of regulation, in terms of inability to sell insurance across state lines, in terms of, you know, allowing hospitals to merge. And many hospital markets, by the way, are governed essentially by what's known as certificates of need, meaning you and I couldn't go start a hospital in a town that only had one hospital, because often the certificate of need would have the hospital board sort of dictate whether there's a need for another hospital or not, you know, and so they could say, no, there isn't. And then the local hospital keeps its monopoly. And so there are just so many barriers in the U.S. to competition. The American healthcare system is not remotely competitive, and that's why prices are high.
And do you so? I mean, what do you think based upon that knowledge? Right, that we have these we have essentially 50 different sort of regimes that control the insurance and also the number, you know, issuing basically licenses for hospitals. Like, what is there a way to override that from a federal standpoint, or is it I mean, how do we break up those monopolies? Because, you know, like, I do know that there have been, you know, half a dozen maybe states that have allowed for the selling of across the state lines. But like you say, it's very difficult for the insurance companies to enter into a new market because of how Byzantine the different states are in terms of their laws. You can't mandate. Could you force a spinoff from every local hospital? I mean, how would you go about doing that in that sector in particular, deal with that the different monopolies?
So I would I would prevent almost any new hospital mergers, you know, in highly concentrated towns and cities. That's as a starting point. I would prevent any future mergers in insurance markets or whatever the market is that makes it more highly concentrated. In the book, I talk about there's extensive research showing that once you get below six players in an industry or in a geography, you end up with higher prices. So that's as a starting point. You know, we shouldn't be allowing mergers down to 5, 4, 3, 2, or even one players, you know, and particularly one hospital system for a town. So that's as a starting point. On the insurance side, I think that if you got rid of McCarran Ferguson, took it to the national level, and made sure that anyone who was decently capitalized, you know, could start an insurance company, you know, I guarantee you that you would have a lot of people competing to offer better insurance by signing people up. Right?
So you make a federal standards. You basically, in some respects, you know, you expand on the patient protection side of the ACA PPI. You make a federal standard for insurance, and you make a single standard in terms of regulators, regardless of the state.
Exactly. So what you don't want to do is necessarily just say, you know what, sell across state lines, but go, you know, go to Utah or go to Alaska, or whichever state provides you with the most lenient insurance and regulation.
Right, right.
Have decent regulation at the federal level, and then allow people to sell wherever they want. You know, it should be like pencils or Coca-Cola or gasoline. You just sell it across state lines. But the issue is when you can create these local fiefdoms, you know, you end up with places like Alabama or Hawaii, which have no choice. You know, and so that's on the insurance side. I think if you look at, you know, in the book, we have a chapter on patents. And if you look at how that's been applied in the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, it's just a complete disaster where companies have been able to buy generic competitors. They've been able to offer exclusionary payments to make sure that generic companies don't even bring their drugs to market. You know, so the kinds of price gouging that you see in the U.S. pharmaceutical market is absurd, and it could be dealt with via sensible regulation, you know, to outlaw exclusionary payments, to approve generics, to approve the importation of drugs that the FDA has already said are good. I mean, the European regulators are good. The Japanese regulators are good. You know, you could basically create a whitelist, like a whitelist effectively of countries. You know, so if a European generic company wants to sell into the U.S., let them do it. I mean, there's nothing new. These chemicals are understood. They're tested. You know, if they satisfy European regulations, why should we not allow them here? But essentially preventing the reimportation of drugs keeps them high. And then there's, you know, loads of other things like reformulations, which allow the current drug people to further and further extend their patents and gouge people.
All right. Lastly, and I don't mean to press too hard on this, but in terms of on the hospital side, I hear the prescription of basically stop digging, right? Like no more mergers going forward. How do you refill some of that hole? Do you basically just change the regime in which hospitals are allowed to sort of, get developed? I mean, I would imagine the capital requirements for starting a new hospital in any context are going to be rather large.
Yeah, so what's fascinating is, when we started this conversation, we were talking about sort of left and right, and, I would be sort of right of center. Most of the people who care about monopolies tend to be left of center. I think that this is a bipartisan issue that is not a left or right issue. And what's fascinating is that if you look at, for example, hospital mergers, there's a Republican representative from Indiana, Jim Banks,
yep,
who has put forward a bill to ban hospital mergers in highly concentrated markets. And one of the solutions in terms of incentivizing hospitals to break up is to say, do you know what? The government's one of the biggest payers in healthcare. The government will pay less if it's a hospital in a highly concentrated market. And, so the rather than simply force the breakups, the government could essentially say, do you know what? We're just not going to pay you a lot if you want to be that big and, that powerful. And, I think that might work. It's not my law. I haven't put that forward, but that is a law that's being put forward by a Republican member of the House. And so I think that, both sides of the aisle are recognizing that things are completely broken and messed up and they need to change. And so I certainly hope that we end up with fewer mergers, breakups, spinoffs, and, ultimately sort of deconsolidating some of these markets because, there's no competition.
I would encourage people to read the book. I mean, because you cover cable, you cover airlines, concrete and beer. But I need to jump to the chapter about buybacks because that is sort of my bailiwick. Talk about how stock buybacks play into this.
Certainly. So everyone thinks that buybacks are evil. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think they're wrong in the way that they think about buybacks. Buybacks essentially are returning money from the company to its owners, to the shareholders. Now, companies could do that via dividends, so send them a check or a payment, or they could buy back some of their own shares and reduce the number of shares. Dividends tend to get taxed sort of at income tax rates, and then buybacks tend to get taxed at sort of capital gains tax rates. But if companies are sitting on a lot of cash, they're going to return cash to the investors. And if there's not a lot of competition and industries are oligopolies, they're not really going to want to invest. They're not going to want to create more plants or invest in capital equipment. They're not going to want to pay the workers more. They don't have to. There's no competition. And so I think buybacks are a symptom. They're not a cause of the problem. So they merely express the actual cause, which is the lack of competition, the monopolies and oligopolies. And when companies have no competition, they can earn a lot of money, they can get very fat, and that's what leads to the companies then to make so much money that they have it sitting around the balance sheet that they can go out and do a buyback. But banning buybacks essentially is dealing with the cause rather than the actual effect.
Interesting. And so that gets back to your where you started with that notion of return on capital not going down properly.
Exactly. And unless you deal with that, the companies are just going to keep on piling cash up on their balance sheet. And you know what? They'll dividend it out, right? Or they'll take themselves private eventually, sort of borrowing debt and just buying the entire shares back. And so what we have to do is to reintroduce competition, make sure these companies are not, sitting on loads and loads of cash, due to lack of competition. And I guarantee you that's going to solve the buyback problem.
It's interesting because, one of the people we've interviewed, and we're going to play an interview with him next week, is Bill Lozonek, who is a professor up at UMass, whose theory about buybacks is that it just simply provides the wrong incentive for a very small group of people, that being it's not so much that it's returning to the shareholders, it's that it's returning to a specific narrow set of shareholders in the C-suites and in the board of directors who then are, you know, have a misaligned incentive with their the corporations that they're overseeing, which is short-term bumps in the stocks actually make them the most amount of money they can make in this instance. What's your perception? What's your sense of that?
So I really like his research. I like his writing. I think that sort of his contributions to the debate have been terrific. So I can only say wonderful things about what he's done. I think he does hit the nail on the head when he talks about essentially this idea of sort of the shareholder supremacy, you know, and this really comes from Milton Friedman. And you know, he was saying that the only goal of the firm is to produce a high return for shareholders. And as if, you know, the companies were not part of their community, as if they were not employers, you know, as if they had no broader considerations to the government or to the environment. And, you know, the only thing that mattered was making money. And I do think that companies should make money. And I do think that's, you know, one of the most important things. But it's not the only thing. And it's not certainly to the exclusion of all other things. And so, you know, if companies think that sort of short-term gains, you know, and to goose the stock price is the only thing going, then what this often leads to actually is perversely sort of worse long-term returns for the shareholder, because they're not investing for the long term. They're not looking after sort of their communities and their customers in the long term. And I think that's very much what we've seen, you know, with many companies, you know, and you see this where companies have borrowed money to buy back shares often, or they've levered themselves up to pay money out to shareholders. You know, look at GE, for example, right? GE generates loads and loads of money, but they basically were doing so many buybacks that, you know, they levered up their balance sheet, you know, made it incredibly unhealthy. And now they're having to break themselves up. And, you know, this is an example of sort of the short-term buyback obsession versus a sort of long-term orientation.
I bet you the CEO of GE, who authorized those buybacks, and the board that signed off on it, I bet they all made a lot of money off of that.
Oh yeah, so Welch and Immelt, for example, are the two CEOs who did that, and they're very well off, very comfortable, and they're not around to deal with the cleanup.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, it's a fascinating book, great research, and I appreciate that in your conclusion you actually offer very specific solutions and remedies, which we tend not to find at the end of a lot of the books that we talk about here. So much appreciated. The book is The Myth of Capitalism. Jonathan Tepper, we will put a link on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right, folks. It's interesting to see the potential, in my mind, of some type of transpartisan agreement on these problematic aspects. Now, I think probably for some of us on the left, it doesn't go quite far enough, but certainly even the principles embedded in that his name now escapes me again, but the Republican proposal to use government purchasing power as a way of incentivizing the breaking up of hospitals. You could also do that even more effectively if you made government purchasing power of these services even that much more powerful and monopsonistic. So these are issues that, you know, I think increasingly and certainly, you know, across the board. I mean, I personally think that breaking up Facebook and Google is a much better solution than to nationalize them. Whether to deal with the economic concentration, the political concentration, or these questions of deplatforming, because one, I don't want the government to be, you know, selling advertising against videos. Frankly, I don't want the government to be in that business.
Well, do they have to turn a profit, though?
well, competition would start kicking
it's
in.
It's not so much that they have to turn a profit, but we do. I mean, we as a YouTube content provider want that funding from advertising, theoretically, right? And so, but I don't want the government administering it. I don't want the government selling ads on my, I just don't want them to do that. And the amount of issues that would be involved in terms of First Amendment rights and whatnot, very, very complicated. However, to break up these entities in a bunch of different ways would solve a lot of those issues in terms of like the power of these platforms in within society. I tend to use the word, you know, citizen more, I think, than Jonathan Tepper would in this analysis. But there are obviously both, there's a silo of economic problems and a silo of just sheer democracy problems associated with this. And just citizenship problems, I think.
I mean, okay, people always tell me that socialism is utopian, and, you know, to some degree it is. But the idea of having this bipartisan agreement to regulate the tech industry also seems quite utopian to me.
Well, I mean, we've had it in the past. I mean, it doesn't have to be bipartisan, frankly. We had a more or less bipartisan perspective on antitrust that governed for 70 years from, the beginning of the 19th century, excuse me, at the beginning of the 20th century till about 1985 or so, when a new perspective on what antitrust was. And we've talked to other people about this in the past, and we're going to have more guests on the future, but I would recommend people go back and listen to Barry Lynn. And I think we talked to we had a couple of interviews about this change that Robert Bork promoted before his days of being borked at the Supreme Court hearings, where the notion of antitrust went from keeping and the notion of antitrust mutated from big is bad because it concentrates economic, political power and strips power from the citizenry to the only principle in determining antitrust should be whether it positively impacts the consumer in terms of price.
Yeah, I think guys like this, like libertarians, is that the phrase that's been trickling up? I think they are genuine allies when it comes to antitrust stuff. And I think like the history of this country has shown like that becomes very popular, especially in moments of concentration like this. I think just when it comes to redistribution is when you lose them, basically.
Wait, what was the name of the book and the author? Brooklyn Law School. And it was a great book, and it escapes me at the moment. We need to tag our podcast better. But we did a couple of these, particularly about a year and a half ago. I think we had three or four people on. So it's not utopian insofar as it's happened before.
Well,
I'm
thinking about the current makeup, though, of the Republican Party, especially.
Highly
as
unlikely.
As well as the Democratic Party, which is the only party that would even try to regulate these entities in any way.
I think there's a fairly significant, I mean, certainly Elizabeth Warren represents a major, major focal point of power for a renewed and vigorous antitrust movement. Had Hillary Clinton won the presidency, I'm quite sure, and my understanding is that the first or second quarter of 2017 would have been dominated by an argument about this within the Democratic Party, at the very least. And so, yes, I think it's unlikely. However, you know, once you have one, the law of Meet the Press is if you have one Democrat who signs on to something, it's bipartisan. So, you know, if we have one Republican, you really need, you know, a lot more than that to make that argument. But there's certainly...
But anti-monopoly is a strong issue.
Anti-monopoly is a strong issue, and I do think there is rhetoric that can appeal to elements of the center right in terms of anti-monopoly rhetoric. I mean, I definitely think small business folk, you know, theoretically the bedrock of the Republican Party.
I think the center right is going away, though, don't you? Like, the Republican Party is Trump now, and everybody is bowing down to him.
I think
he hates regulations.
The vast majority of the Republican Party. But again, I think there is an argument where, you know, antitrust is, you can certainly frame as anti-establishment.
And what also some of the, well, definitely that, and also some of this, you know, as you say, and it's true, a element of the center right, a large amount of the center right is in the Democratic Party. And I say what I always say in these things, which is, I mean, this isn't my particular political project, but I think it's great in the sense that if somebody coming from the position that someone like Jonathan Tepper comes from is writing persuasive cases against monopolies because he feels a concern about the moment we're in because of how we're doing capitalism, that means the whole terrain is shifting in the right direction.
I just like to be the pragmatic and pessimistic one for once. It was fun.
There you go.
Feels good.
All right. We got to take a quick break, head into the fun half. A reminder, this program relies on its supporters for its production. You, our members, those of you who are our members, provide this program with 96.3% of our revenue. We want to bring that up to 96.9. Maybe we can bust through 97.3%. So we are looking at you. If you listen to this program on a regular basis, if you like it, if you have some extra change in your pocket, and maybe you've given up, if you've given up cigarettes, my gosh.
If you're giving up cigarettes, you're living large. You could buy whatever you want.
But
buy a house.
But maybe you found a place that sells your coffee for 2¼ instead of 3¼. Well, then you've just bought yourself a Majority Report membership by far. Even you bought two, if that's the case. Assuming we've done the calculations on this. Assuming five coffees a week. You've bought yourself two Majority Report memberships. So head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, speaking of coffee, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, make your coffee at home, and you buy yourself three Majority Report memberships practically.
Get your coffee with justice. I like the Just
I'm going coffee. To Madison.
Just Coffee's so awesome because I can do jokes during their ads.
I'm going to Madison this weekend.
Really?
Actually, what are you doing in Madison? Going to a wedding.
Touring the justcoffee.coop factory. Excuse me. I shouldn't have said that publicly. It all comes from Fairtrade.
I'm going to...
It turns out Just Coffee's secretly in the new
if
Fox.
If they're open on Saturday, I'm going to go by there.
You actually. Should.
That would
Send
be a fun
our regards,
little...
please.
Oh, yeah. I should do that. Go by and do a little tour. Maybe do like a little Instagram live stream from the Just Coffee thing, Matt. You're not even listening to anything I'm saying.
That was awesome.
Like, I was so excited
I
about
love
it.
Matt's balls. Matt, just like, yeah, what? Yeah.
Do a live Instagram stream from the Just Coffee store.
The problem is usually when you're not listening, yeah, it's powerful stuff. Usually when you're not listening to Sam, you could just go with like yes, exactly, that's ridiculous. And what they did was the Supreme Court said that, but people don't take the court seriously. But you got to get in when he's actually excited about something, which is like 5% of the time. You got to tap into a different
tenor. I was super excited
tenor.
About that.
And that's when you have to be like, oh, yes, we should take on an enormously impractical, highly time-consuming project.
Folks should check out our Instagram account. It is exploding. We have we basically just launched it, and in the past week, we've already increased our followers by 50%.
Boom.
There you go. Michael, today is Tuesday. Oh, my gosh. Week is flying by.
The week is flying by. Vacation is in the horizon. Tonight, actually, and I guess one more schedule change. Since we're on vacation next week, we're doing two Michael Brooks shows this week. One tonight at our usual time and one on Friday. I would suggest that people check out the Unlocked Illicit History on Sunday. Zach Carter and I on why you shouldn't blame Howard Schultz. You should blame the 1990s. Cultural History of Oligarchy, the Third Way, and the Schultz Candidacy. Tonight, the great Mark Blythe joins us. We're talking about the Green New Deal, Brexit, and why Trump can't do his economic populism scam anymore. So he has to double down on xenophobia and breaking down the Ilhan Omar thing, the debut of Rasta Kamala Harris, the most demented takes in defense of Amy Klobuchar, and a whole bunch more. Patreon.com/TMBS, Patreon.com/TMBS, or on our YouTube channel, which is where we will live stream.
Jamie.
Yeah, so Monday, for patrons only, we just dropped... let me put myself on camera. There we go. Andy, AP Andy, our producer, is currently in Mexico because we all go to Mexico a lot as part of our, you know, international Antifa jobs. He came upon one of the world's foremost bookchin scholars, Blair Taylor, at Puerto Vallarta Bear Weekend, which is still like very weird to me how the two really coincide. But apparently a lot of Murray Bookchin tramp stamps in the bear community. Who knows?
There's an eco preserve there for bears.
Yes, exactly. So
I didn't know.
So our baby bear cub, Andy, talks to Blair about radical municipalism, Bookchin's concepts of democracy and citizenship, Blair's Institute for Social Ecology, and the formation of the Symbiosis Network, which is like a anarchist municipalist mutual aid network throughout the continent. He talks about the PKK and Rojava, Bookchin's criticism of fellow Vermonter Bernie Sanders, and what sort of kinky things the old man was getting up to in Vermont.
And Matt.
Coming up this weekend on Literary Hangover is The Unparalleled Adventures by One Hans Fall, which may be the first science fiction story to have a spaceship go to the moon. So. Mm.
Quesabile Ramen.
Wait, what was the name of that?
Democracy book? Against Domination.
That was a really good interview. Very smart man.
People should go back and maybe we'll replay that one. That lays out, and we've had others. Barry Lynn from the Open Democracy, Matt Stoller, Lena. Gosh. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number, and we will see you there. Don't forget, you can take a leap into the future with Capterra.com, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra can make you an informed decider no matter what your business needs. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today and find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/majority. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/majority.